This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Barack Obama was running for president, he promised to change Washington's culture of lobbyists. Here's one of his campaign ads.
The pharmaceutical industry wrote into the prescription drug plan that Medicare could not negotiate with drug companies. And you know what? The chairman of the committee who pushed the law through went to work for the pharmaceutical industry making $2 million a year.
Imagine that.
That's an example of the same old game playing in Washington. You know, I don't want to learn how to play the game better. I want to put an end to the game playing.
Okay, the person referred to in that ad, the chairman of the committee who pushed through the law and then went to work for the pharmaceutical industry, is Billy Tauzin. Within a few months after Obama became president, his administration was secretly negotiating with Tauzin, who was then head of pharma, the pharmaceutical industry's lobby group. The deal Obama made with the pharmaceutical industry and what he gave up to get their support for his health care reform plan is detailed in an investigative article by my guest Paul Blumenthal. Blumenthal is a senior writer with the Sunlight Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to making government more open and transparent. Paul Blumenthal, welcome to Fresh Air. So why do you think the Obama administration wanted to meet with the pharmaceutical industry? What did he want from them?
I think that what he was looking to do, which was definitely something that he promised to do in the campaign, was to bring everyone to the table. And that included special interest groups and industry groups and try to get them to back a piece of legislation by any means necessary. It was looking at a way to get this done and to defuse the actors and lobbyists in Washington so that they wouldn't run advertising against legislation and they wouldn't lobby against legislation. And that involved making some serious concessions to industry.
So let's look, before we get into the actual meetings, like who met and what kind of dealings they had, let's just talk about the agreement that the Obama administration reached with the pharmaceutical industry. What did the Obama administration get out of it? And then we'll talk about what the pharmaceutical industry got out of it.
Well, what the Obama administration got out of it was taking the biggest lobby in Washington and putting them onto the side of healthcare reform as opposed to having them oppose the legislation. They received around $100 million in advertising to support the legislation spent by pharma, the industry trade group. That certainly is a big deal if you're trying to push a kind of bill like this.
And what did the pharmaceutical industry get out of this deal with the Obama administration?
Basically, what they got was that Congress would not legislate any kind of cost cutting that would make a serious dent in industry profits. And that includes taking things off the table like reimportation of drugs from first world countries or
allowing buying drugs at cheaper prices from other countries like Canada.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, what else?
Allowing Medicare to negotiate for cheaper drugs, just as the Veterans Administration does in their healthcare program. These were pretty big Democratic policies that had been supported by the Democrats since 2003 and by then-candidate Obama in the 2008 elections. And the administration allowed these kind of policies to be pushed off to the side so that they could gain the support of the pharmaceutical industry.
The pharmaceutical industry promised the Obama administration savings up to $80 billion. Through what?
Most of that was through partially closing what's called the donut hole in Medicare Part D, where at a certain point of spending on prescription drugs, you enter this hole where you don't have any coverage for that amount of money. And once you get over a certain amount, you have more coverage. So it was $30 billion to partially cover those drugs being spent for people spending over a certain amount of money within Part D on prescription drugs. That was the majority of it.
So let's look at who was at these secret meetings between the Obama administration and the pharmaceutical industry. First of all, how many meetings were there? Was this like a series of meetings that ranged over a period of time?
This was definitely a series of meetings with the White House that totaled around four or five that show up on the White House visitor logs, which the White House has made publicly available for the first time. And the people involved are Billy Tauzin, who is the pharmaceutical industry's chief lobbyist for their trade group Pharma, and the other main actors include the CEO of Pfizer, which is the largest pharmaceutical industry company, CEO of AstraZeneca, the CEO of Abbott Laboratories. These are pretty much the main people who you see show up in most of these meetings with the White House and with the Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus.
And who are the main representatives from the Obama administration meeting with these members of the pharmaceutical industry?
The chief people include the chief of staff at the White House, Rahm Emanuel, and the deputy chief of staff, who is involved in more of the meetings, Jim Messina, who happens to be the former chief of staff to Max Baucus in the Senate.
So Max Baucus, who is the head of the Senate Finance Committee that drew up the Senate health care bill, he already had contacts with the healthcare industry. How did he make those contacts?
Well, those contacts were made over a series of years. He was previously the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee when the Republicans were in charge, when they were passing prescription drug expansion for Medicare. And he was deeply involved in those negotiations for that legislation. He also has a large number of former staffers who have gone on to lobby, and a number of those have become lobbyists for pharmaceutical industry groups and for other healthcare organizations. One of the chief former staffers of his is his former chief of staff, David Castagnetti, who's a major lobbyist in Washington who lobbies for Pharma and America's Health Insurance Plan, among another maybe 10 or so healthcare companies. Baucus is also a major fundraiser and from 2003 to 2008 raised well over $1 million from the healthcare industry for his election.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Blumenthal. He's a senior writer with the Sunlight Foundation, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group that advocates for more openness and transparency in government. Now, Billy Tauzin is an interesting character, and he is the chief lobbyist for Pharma, the main pharmaceutical industry lobby. He has an interesting history in terms of how he crossed over from Congress to the pharmaceutical industry. Tell us a little bit about his history as a congressman.
Well, Billy Tauzin was a longtime Democrat in the House who in 1994, after the Democrats lost their majority, switched over to being a Republican. As a Republican, he held the same seniority that he had as a Democrat and began to quickly move up to become the chairman of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, which is one of the most powerful committees in the House of Representatives. And in 2002 and 2003, he took up this issue of expanding Medicare to cover prescription drugs. And at this time, it was a pretty controversial issue for Republicans, as many of them opposed this new expansion of a safety net program. And Tauzin seriously pushed for this bill, helped craft the bill, and in a lot of instances met behind closed doors with pharmaceutical industry leaders to help craft the bill, which did not include any of these cost-cutting measures that we've already talked about that he later on got to keep out of the 2009 healthcare reform bill. Reimportation of drugs, negotiations like the VA has. So the bill was seen by a lot of people as really just a handout to this industry. And pretty soon afterwards, he announced he was retiring from Congress and that he was in negotiations with the pharmaceutical industry lobby to become their president at a $2 million a year salary.
So how much of a role do you think that the pharmaceutical industry leaders and lobbyists who met with Max Baucus, how much of a role did they have on shaping the bill that emerged from his committee?
I don't know if I can totally answer that question, but I think considering Baucus's history, I'm sure that there was a decent amount of industry influence. I think that the key in what happened in Baucus's committee is that the White House made this deal with the pharmaceutical companies and told them to only go through Baucus, that they were only supposed to work with him, and no other committee in Congress really knew about these deals going on behind the scenes, except for Baucus. And so the entire healthcare reform effort really relied on whatever process Max Baucus was going to go about using to create a bill, which wound up being a fairly drawn-out process after bills had passed every other relevant committee in the House and the Senate.
So what about the House of Representatives? Like, there was no similar committee from that House that was represented in this deal-making?
No. The major committee in the House of Representatives is the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, which is headed by Henry Waxman, who's a noted foe of the pharmaceutical industry. And he included a number of these provisions in the House bill that were just verboten for the pharmaceutical industry and the Obama administration, that they had already made this deal on, that whatever Waxman was putting in, it just wasn't going to happen. But what did happen in the House was Waxman's bill really scared the pharmaceutical industry and forced their hand to make the Obama administration admit that a deal was made.
What do you mean by that?
So Waxman's bill passed around July 31st, and then we went into the August recess. And at that time, the Board of Pharma got a little skittish by seeing this bill with everything that they had thought that they would have eliminated. Reimportation of drugs and negotiations for Medicare Part D and a number of other cost-cutting measures that went well above the $80 billion that they had agreed to, and thought that maybe the Obama administration was trying to fool them. And so Billy Towson came out in an article to the LA Times and explained that a deal had been made with the White House and sort of forced the hand of the White House, who a couple days later were quoted as saying that this deal did exist.
So the head lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry leaked the deal that the industry had made with the Obama administration because they were afraid Obama would renege on it after the House passed a bill that had all the things that the industry wanted taken out?
That's correct.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Blumenthal. He's a senior writer with the Sunlight Foundation, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group that advocates for more openness and transparency in government. When Senator Max Baucus was meeting with pharmaceutical lobbyists, working on this compromise that the lobbyists had agreed to with the Obama administration, was he getting money from those lobbyists, too?
Well, I think that Baucus did a very smart thing as a politician handling this kind of issue and actually refused money from healthcare PACs and lobbyists during the course of 2009. So he actually wasn't getting any money in 2009. However, his previous election campaign from 2003 to 2008, he received well over $1 million from healthcare industry players.
Can you give us a sense of how much money and how many lobbyists the pharmaceutical industry has?
Well, the pharmaceutical industry in total certainly spends over $100 million probably on lobbying. I know that the trade group Pharma, who was deeply involved in this, spent $28 million in 2009, which was a record for them, and had hired 165 lobbyists, and that's includes their in-house lobby shop and outside lobbying firms. And from going over these names of these lobbyists, I was able to determine that 137 of them had previous experience in government, whether in Congress or in the executive branch.
How do they do it? How do they push? And what is the money used for? What did that $28 million go to?
I don't know exactly what the $28 million goes to. Lobbying disclosures are very opaque. I know that they're supposed to be transparent disclosures, but they aren't really. And we only really know how much they spend and not what they spend it on. We don't even know the salaries of lobbyists or who lobbyists are meeting with. And it's a serious problem in trying to cover these kinds of issues.
One of the things that the pharmaceutical industry promised to do in its deal with Obama was to spend up to $150 million on advertising. Why was that important to the Obama administration?
Well, they really didn't want to have a replay of 1993 and 1994 with the Harry and Louise ads run against the healthcare reform proposal put out by Bill and Hillary Clinton. And they really wanted to defuse that situation by getting these industry players to back healthcare reform and to have them spend this large sum of money on advertising in key states, in key congressional districts, for pushing members of Congress or pushing their constituents to call their members of Congress in support of the legislation.
Now, you write that the company that was hired to produce the ads and to place the ads was the company that David Axelrod, one of Obama's chief advisors and one of his chief campaign managers, the company that he used to be a partner in.
Yes. His company, which still employs his son and still owes David Axelrod $2 million, was the initial company to be hired to place the beginning $24 million in advertising that was spent through two advocacy organizations that were created in a secret meeting between Jim Messina, John Selib, the chief of staff to Max Baucus, and the pharmaceutical industry and another number of other groups.
Is there anything about that that to you does not pass the sniff test? I mean, I could see why the Obama administration would want that company to do the ads. They obviously felt that company did a great job with the Obama campaign. So is there anything that seems not right to you about that?
It definitely appears questionable, and I don't think we've heard enough answers about why that company was chosen. The pharmaceutical industry says that they chose that company because it was one of the better advertising companies out there, and why wouldn't they go with the company that had run ads for President Obama?
What were some of those ads? Refresh our memories. Which were these ads?
Some of the first ads that they played actually brought back the characters of Harry and Louise from the 1993 advertisements against healthcare reform. And in these advertisements, Harry and Louise are now talking about the rising costs of healthcare and why they actually do need healthcare now. And this was in support of the legislation.
And when those ads were shown, was it clear that it was the pharmaceutical industry who was funding the ads?
Absolutely not, actually. These were run through a advocacy organization called Healthy Economy Now, which included a number of other groups, including labor unions like SEIU and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And they don't have to disclose in their advertising who is paying for these ads, but most of the money came from the pharmaceutical industry and from pharma.
The healthcare bill appears to be stalled. Scott Brown was elected to replace Ted Kennedy's seat in the Senate. He's a Republican, so the Democrats no longer have that 60-seat supermajority that's needed to block a filibuster. So with health care stalled for now, where do you think that compromise between the Obama administration and the pharmaceutical industry stands?
Pharmaceutical industry CEOs are still mostly backing the deal and would still love to see a health care reform bill passed with only the $80 billion in cost cutting. The passage of the bill would certainly be a windfall for the industry. They'd have so many more people with health insurance coverage who would be able to purchase pharmaceuticals. And with the small amount that they agreed to on cost cutting, their profits would shoot up exponentially. There's no doubt that they're happy about what they got out of this for the most part. But they're definitely not thrilled with the fact that they spent $100 to $150 million in advertising, and it really seems like this legislation is not going to pass.
Shortly after Scott Brown was elected to the Senate, Billy Tauzin resigned. He resigned around the second week of February. What do you know about why he resigned?
There are some people, some of the board members are saying that they didn't like his style. And there are other reports that there are a number of board members who weren't involved in this deal who never really liked the deal to begin with. And I think that probably one of the better explanations is that Billy Towson and a number of these board members made this deal, and part of the deal was to spend $100 to $150 million in advertising for a bill that wound up going nowhere. And that's kind of a bad way to run a business, even for a lobbying firm, is to spend that much money and get nothing out of it.
Well, Paul Blumenthal, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Blumenthal is a senior writer with the Sunlight Foundation, which is dedicated to making government more open and transparent. You can find links to his investigative articles on our website, freshair.npr.org. Today, President Obama released a new blueprint for health care reform. Blumenthal says the proposal will not likely find a receptive audience in the pharmaceutical industry. The new plan contains deeper cost cuts than previously agreed to and contains regulations the industry opposes on the relationship between brand name and generic drug companies. On Thursday, President Obama plans to hold a health care summit with Democrats and Republicans. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Chances are you've never heard of William Stuart Halsted, but if you've ever had a surgical procedure of any kind, you could say he's affected your life. Halsted was born in the 1850s, when Americans were in appallingly poor health. Only half the children born lived to age five. More New Yorkers were dying from disease every year than were being born. The practice of medicine was crude, and operations, when conducted, were barbaric. Surgeons worked with dirty hands, and nearly every patient developed serious infections. Our guest Gerald Imber says no one did more to modernize medical surgery than William Halsted. He brought rubber gloves and sterile instruments to the operating room. He developed several innovative surgical techniques and revolutionized medical training. But he also suffered for decades from cocaine and morphine addictions, which he acquired while experimenting with anesthetics for surgery. Gerald Imber is a plastic surgeon who's written several books. His latest is Genius on the Edge, The Bizarre Double Life of Dr. William Stuart Halsted. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Gerald Imber, welcome to Fresh Air. William Halsted, he became known for conducting operations in ways that prevented infection and other advances. But even in his early years, he was an innovator. You tell the story that he did the first emergency blood transfusion, which was kind of a remarkable tale. Tell us what happened.
He was a young surgeon practicing in New York, and he was fairly successful. And his sister was in Albany and was giving birth to a child, and he was called up there to see her and to visit with her, and she began to hemorrhage. And her husband, who happened to be one of Halsted's friends and a physician as well, and the obstetrician couldn't stop the bleeding. And Halsted was called in with them, and they packed her uterus with ice and gauze. And she became very, very weak and pale and was going into shock. And he drew blood from his own veins and injected it to her. And it was claimed that she perked up and this saved her life. In retrospect, there are a couple of amusing things about the story. A few syringes full of blood will not make the difference. It won't. That's not the difference between life and death. The second thing is taking unmatched blood and donating it, as it were, to someone else is a recipe for disaster. And he luckily got away with it, perhaps because of the genetic closeness from sister and brother. But it's an interesting anecdote. It was the first time anyone recorded a blood transfusion in an emergency situation. But he might very well have made the situation worse under different circumstances.
He certainly wasn't afraid in an emergency situation to take direct action. And you begin the book with a remarkable tale involving his mother.
Yes. It's an interesting story. In 1882, Halsted had been in practice for a couple of years, and his mother was visiting this very same sister up in Albany. His mother had lived in New York, and she'd had for a long time had abdominal pain that radiated to her back and a sour taste in her mouth and just constant discomfort. And all the great doctors in New York couldn't make the diagnosis. But while she was visiting in Albany, she became extremely sick, and she became moribund. And Halsted was called up to see her. He arrived in the middle of the night. with all his surgical instruments. He had his mother placed on the kitchen table and examined her, and he noticed under her the right rib cage she had a red hot mass, and when he touched it, she flinched and pulled away, and he immediately made the diagnosis of an acutely inflamed gallbladder with pus in the gallbladder and gallstones. And on the kitchen table in Albany, he put his mother to sleep with some ether that he brought with him. Then he took his instruments and put them in carbolic acid, then dipped his hands in carbolic acid and took a scalpel, opened his mother's abdomen on the kitchen table, then opened her inflamed gallbladder, allowed copious amounts of pus to be removed from the gallbladder, to run out of the gallbladder, removed 7 gallstones, and saved his mother's life. And that was the first recorded incidence of anybody ever having removed gallstones surgically.
Wow.
His mother on the kitchen table in Albany.
And did he repeat the surgery, and did it then become more widely practiced?
It became very widely practiced, and over the course of the next number of years, as sterile technique became available every place and people realized that that's what was necessary for survival, one had two things that weren't available before. One had anesthesia and sterile technique. So people became more adventurous in general, and gallbladder surgery became fairly routinely done. Appendectomies became routinely done. Halsted actually realized that one of the surgeries that had been done throughout history and never successfully was the correction of hernias, inguinal hernias. He devised a method to correct hernia surgery, which was successful in 90-some-odd% of the cases.
Right. And remind us, I mean, a hernia is what it's when a piece of the intestine sort of penetrates the containing wall? You describe it.
That's exactly right. I have nothing to add. I rest your case.
William Halsted was an innovator in specific types of surgery, but you make the case here that what he really did that benefited all surgeons forevermore was to develop techniques which avoided infections, which had been so deadly before. Tell us how he did that.
There were three things he actually did that were critical in that sphere. And those things were, realizing that using sterile technique alone, as Lister had done, wasn't quite good enough, that you had to use truly aseptic technique.
Now that's Joseph Lister, who before him had developed the technique of what, soaking things in carbolic acid?
Carbolic acid,
okay.
Yes, which was the greatest step forward. But Halsted said that kills the infection that's there. Why don't we prevent the infection from getting there? And that's by the development of aseptic technique. And he actually had the audacity as a surgeon in practice 3 years in New York City to get on the staff at Bellevue Hospital and ask them to build a sterile operating room just for his use. And when they laughed him out of the room, he raised the money and built a tent on the grounds of Bellevue Hospital that had a floor laid in maple like a bowling alley, had gas lights and sterilization, and was an operating room that cost $10,000 in the 1880s for his exclusive use. And it was the first sterile operating theater in New York and probably in the world. But taking it a step further, he recognized the fact that the surgeon's hands were the main culprit in spreading the infection. So he insisted on all sorts of sterilization techniques for the surgeon's hands, ultimately resulting in, serendipitously perhaps, but resulting in the use and development of rubber gloves for surgery.
Yeah, how did that happen? Because he was cleansing the hands. How did they move to rubber gloves?
Well, his scrub nurse, when he was at Johns Hopkins, became allergic to the caustic solutions with which the hands were cleaned, and she had this terrible dermatitis. And one day he was visiting at the Goodyear Rubber Company in New York for something else, and he said, well, why don't you develop a pair of rubber gloves for us that we could use to protect the nurse's hands from the caustic solutions and that we could sterilize? And they did so, and it was very useful for nurses, and the nurses adopted it regularly. And the surgeons didn't adopt it regularly for another 6 years. But when they did, That was the greatest step forward in preventing the transmission of infection to patients.
How did his idea spread?
Well, his idea spread because he was the first great teacher of surgery. And at one point, the overwhelming majority of the professors of surgery around the United States were all his disciples. So the Halsted method of surgery, the Halsted method of teaching surgery, was what became the American method of surgery, which became the most important in the world. From his seed came almost all the great surgeons in America, and every one of us, every practicing surgeon in any specialty, maybe in the world, but definitely in America, can trace his lineage back to Halsted. And every patient who has ever had successful surgery for any problem in America owes a debt of gratitude to Halsted, because his technique of teaching surgeons and teaching surgeons what to do is what turned the corner for us.
I want to talk about one more particular kind of surgery that he innovated, and that was the treatment of breast cancer. First of all, I mean, this was not an uncommon cancer to women in his time. What was typically done before?
Well, there were a number of things that affected what was done with breast cancer prior to the turn of the 20th century. And basically in that Victorian era, there was no self-examination, and women didn't go to doctors to have their breasts examined. People didn't go to doctors, period, until there was some emergency. And there was no such thing as a checkup. So women would know something was wrong when a baseball-sized tumor was felt, or there was a separating mass, an infected mass in their breast. And of course, as we know now, that's way too late for successful treatment in most cases. So what was done in those days was basically watch people die. And then some people had the idea of removing the tumor and the local tissue and removing the breast. And you have to remember that the patients, for the most part, were patients with very advanced disease. And the way a successful treatment of that disease was measured was not by ultimate 5-year or 10-year survival rates, but by the absence of local recurrence of the disease. So you do the mastectomy, and if there wasn't cancer visible in the area of the chest later, then it was considered something of a success. Halsted developed a method by which the breast and the central tumor and the whole breast around it and the underlying musculature were removed in one piece, which is called en bloc, in one large piece. And he never cut through the tumor because he knew that would spread it. And he took the lymph nodes out in the surrounding areas. And he had more than a 50% incidence of absence of local recurrence or cure of cancer by the yardstick of the day, whereas everybody else had a virtual 0% success rate in curing the cancer. And he called his operation the radical operation for cure of cancer of the breast, which it was. And that became what we know as the radical mastectomy, which was the gold standard operation for the next 50 or 60 years, and which, because of innovative doctors and pressure from women's groups, ultimately became evolved into the modified radical mastectomy, and then evolved into the lumpectomy with radiation.
Halsted spent his early years in New York, but eventually settled in Baltimore because he was on the faculty of Johns Hopkins University. And a good part of your book describes what an innovative place it was. Just give us a little sense of what was unique about Johns Hopkins and its place in the history of American medical education.
Well, the Johns Hopkins Hospital was opened in 1889. And it was really the first hospital that had the idea of being integrated into a medical school with professors who would work at the hospital and in the medical school rather than people who would drop by to teach a little bit. And it was the first place that actually revered science and began with the idea of promoting scientific medicine. And Hopkins, Mr. Hopkins, in his will, when he left some $7 million for the creation of the hospital and the university, made it clear that the best men available in the world were the first priority. And the people who were on his board of trustees took that to heart. And they found the best people in the world in the period of 1880, 85 or 86 when they were being recruited. And these included William Osler, who was perhaps the most important physician ever, William Welsh, who was the great pathologist and the ambassador of scientific medicine to the world, William Halstead and the great gynecologist Howard Kelly. But it was the first place where a scientific academic faculty was gathered for the teaching and advancement of medicine. And they had research laboratories, which never happened before.
Well, Gerald Ember, there's another side to Halstead's life, and that is his narcotic addictions, which began with cocaine. How did he first get introduced to it?
Well, the story starts with, of all people, Sigmund Freud. In 1885, Freud was a neurologist in Vienna. And he had read about this new drug, this new alkaloid, cocaine, which allegedly German troops were taking and were able to stay up for days on end and fight and not eat. Freud got some cocaine. He tried it himself. He felt it had great potential, and he enjoyed the sensation of using it as well. And he also noticed that there was a numbness of his tongue and any place that the drug touched. And he and a friend started using it for topical anesthesia for people with an eye disease called trachoma, which is very painful. And they found that the eye became numb and the pain from the disease was abolished. So he had the idea that perhaps it might be useful other places. But meantime, some young man who was working with him began to use the cocaine to numb the eye and to do surgery on the eye under cocaine anesthesia. He published that. Halstead read about it in New York, in the New York Medical Journal. And a week later, he got a supply of cocaine, and he started injecting cocaine into all of his medical students and all of his associates to determine how he could best block nerve impulses. And his idea was that if it makes things numb, that it could block the impulse from a nerve, stop pain, and you could do surgery under local anesthesia. And he began to use it successfully and used it on about 1,000 patients at Roosevelt Hospital where he was working in the outpatient department. And he also introduced it to dentists to be used for local anesthesia for dentistry, and it changed the face of dentistry. But while he was learning how to use cocaine, there were a number of side effects that people had, but the worst of it was that the majority of the medical students involved became addicted. All of his associates became addicted. A number of them died, and a number of them just dropped out.
And he began using it himself, too, and he became addicted?
Well, yeah. He began using it on himself because he experimented on himself first. And he not only liked the feeling that it gave him socially, but he soon became addicted to it and developed a tolerance to it. He needed to have the cocaine, and to get that same level of euphoria, the dosage that he needed increased. And he was injecting enormous quantities of cocaine. And at times, the things he wrote were total gibberish. And people would visit with him and say he stayed up all night talking nonsense in an animated fashion. And finally, his family members did what we would call an intervention. And they took him off to Butler Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, where obviously cocaine addiction was not very well known. It was not heard of. So they did the only sensible thing to break the cocaine addiction. They treated him with morphine. So he became addicted to morphine also.
And did there come a point in which the dangers of the drug were realized and people stopped using it as an anesthetic, or what happened?
Well, not very soon. Once Halstead got his life almost under control, he never quite did. That, of course, was the precipice on which his genius was balanced. But once he got his life in order, he would never voluntarily use cocaine as a local anesthetic because he shied away from it. He kept on using it as his addictive drug of choice. But he just didn't want other people to use it, and he was against it because he knew what it did. But cocaine was a great local anesthetic. And until the advent of a drug that we all know as Novocaine, cocaine was what every dentist used, what every minor surgery was done under, what most hernia repairs were done under. As long as the dose was very small and it was limited and other medications were given afterwards, it didn't result in the patients becoming addicted. But cocaine was what you were injected with when you went to have a cavity filled.
It's interesting that Halstead wasn't even a drinker. I mean, but these addictions stayed with him after he went from New York to Baltimore to work at Johns Hopkins and became this admired, you know, figure of enormous stature in medicine, right?
Well, he was, you know, abstemious, as you mentioned, and you know, he was judgmental, and he was difficult, and he was the sort of person that was forbidding, and but the same token, he was a human being, and he was as weak as anyone else. And breaking the hold of cocaine without having anyone supporting you wasn't an easy thing. So he became very addicted to morphine on a daily basis because the treatment of the cocaine addiction with morphine created two drugs to which he was addicted. One which made him excitable and high, and the other made him pacific and relaxed. And so the morphine he took every day, every work day, and sometimes he took a little too much and that didn't work out. And occasionally he had withdrawal symptoms, and certainly that didn't work out. But for the most part, for 30-some years, he managed this, and no one was aware of it.
Halstead also seems to have been obsessive about certain aspects of his life, like his dress and his food. What was? Give us some examples of that.
Obsessive hardly describes it. You know, it's interesting that the neurosis that makes you great is also the neurosis that makes you crazy. And Halstead was so fastidious about his dress that he had his shirts made at Charvet in Paris in large, large quantities, and then he sent his shirts back to Paris to be laundered because he felt no one in America could wash and iron a shirt. When he made coffee, he would pick coffee beans for size and color, and they had to all match precisely before he ground them and used them. And it goes on forever. That's the way he lived his life. He was obsessive and rigid and a perfectionist in certain portions of his life, whereas in other portions of his life, he was totally negligent, totally forgetful, and not at all the same person. For example, he could leave a patient in a hospital bed for weeks on end and forget to operate on them. It's just who he was, and no one would ever remind him because he didn't want to incur his wrath. And he was really a very complex individual.
Yeah, leaving them in the hospital bed, not on the operating table, right?
Precisely. They never made it to the operating table.
Do you think that these obsessive traits came with the drug addiction or preceded that?
I think they preceded it. And, you know, in as one gets older, one becomes a caricature of his own self. And I think the same thing happened to Halstead, and there were a number of factors acting on that. One, that no one ever corrected him because he was William Stewart Halstead. Two, he did have the lack of inhibitions that come with drug use. And he was odd to begin with, so that with no checks and balances, he did in fact become a caricature of the person he was in the old days in New York, although his surgical personality had changed dramatically because in New York he was fast, dexterous surgeon, and once the locale changed to Johns Hopkins, he became a slow, plodding, thoughtful surgeon. His results may have been excellent in both places, but the surgeons who came to visit him in Hopkins that knew him in New York didn't recognize him.
You know, I wonder if since, you know, a lot of people are reluctant to deal with addiction and believe they can manage it in their lives. Is it unsettling to find a story of someone who accomplished so much while being addicted for 35 years?
Boy, I wrestled with this one because to me it's terribly counterintuitive what he did. And I like to say that if he – look what he did while compromised by drugs. Think of what he could have done without being compromised by drugs. Other people say perhaps he needed that to loosen him up in some way. I absolutely reject that. I think that that's a fallacy. You know, there are numerous examples of people who think they're so creative when they're stoned, and they come back and look at what it was that they created, and it's laughable. I think one has to look at it as this man had the ability to succeed despite the disability, not because of the disability.
Gerald Imber, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Gerald Imber is the author of Genius on the Edge, The Bizarre Double Life of Dr. William Stuart Halstead. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. You can find an excerpt from Imber's book on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. And you can follow us on Twitter and friend us on Facebook at NPR Fresh Air.